Support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing service to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Joanne Vissian in memory of her mother, Jean Vissian, on the date of her birth. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up in this portion of the program, an archive interview from July 12th of this year. As this is an archive interview, we won't be taking your calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of Ruth Harkness, a New York socialite, the widow of an adventurer who decided she would take up her husband's 1930s quest to bring a live panda out of China. Harkness succeeded. She and the panda became celebrities. They were invited to lunches, dinners, even to tea. When the panda, Su Lin, was displayed at the Brookfield Zoo, he drew 53,000 visitors in one day. Brookfield has yet to match that impressive draw. Our guest this afternoon is Vicky Constantine Croak. She is the author of The Lady and the Panda, The True Adventures of the First American Explorer to Bring Back China's Most Exotic Animal. Vicky Croak tells readers early in the going that she is amazed by the story of Ruth Harkness. Here's one reason, and let me quote from the book. Harkness has been quietly canonized by the few conservationists, scholars, and zoologists who have fully studied the panda hunting era. They know that what began in Ruth Harkness's serene mountain camp was an event that would shake the world, helping to change the way Americans perceived the widespread hunting of exotic animals. Vicky Croak writes the Animal Beat column for the Boston Globe. She has been a contributing reporter for the NPR program Living on Earth, a show you can hear on this radio station Saturday evenings at 7 o'clock. In addition to The Lady and the Panda, Croak is the author of The Modern Ark, the story of zoos, past, present, and future. Vicky, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, this woman, Ruth Harkness, was ahead of her time. She was a champion of conservation. And you note that in the 1930s, this was an alien concept. What was the view of exotic animals held by people of the day? And how was it that Ruth Harkness came to her view of wildlife?
Ruth Harkness was a real sentimentalist about animals, cats and dogs mostly, were the species that she had connection with. At that time that Ruth went to look for the giant panda, her husband was among a group of very elite hunters. These guys were mostly Ivy League educated. They were independently wealthy, and they were very adventurous, and they made the newspapers everywhere with their catches. So that was kind of the mentality of the time toward animals, was very much that you go out and bag them, and you bring them back, generally dead, and they were stuffed and put into museums of natural history. By the 30s, zoos were also looking for specimens, and they were caught and brought back alive, but the general perception was that you wrestled them and subdued them, and you brought them back in cages, which is, of course, not the way that Ruth brought back the baby panda.
Yeah. Now, her success in bringing this panda out of China fed the craving for the species. How did that affect her, being this sentimental woman who, you know, had a different kind of an idea for what you do with exotic animals?
Right. She had a her vision of her mission was that she would go and get at least one breeding pair of pandas. and that eventually there might be a self-sustaining population of pandas in captivity in the United States, which in fact has been a very elusive goal here in the United States for a long, long time. And she brought back one panda in 1936. She returned to China and was able to bring yet another panda back. As it turned out, both were males. Both were presumed to be females at the time. On her third expedition, she secured yet another very young panda. But by that time, she had set in motion a kind of gold rush to bring pandas back. The United States was dealing with what was always called in the press pandemonium. And other hunters were in a mad, mad rush to bring back as many specimens as they could. That meant that many died during the hunting process. Many more died in captivity and en route to the United States. And Harkness felt in 1938 that she saw evidence of giant pandas being wiped out of some of the valleys that she had hunted in. So in 38, when she had her third panda in hand, ready to come back to the United States, disheartened by what she saw in front of her, she turned her expedition around and went back up into the mountains and set her panda free. And just as a side note, I interviewed George Schaller, who's one of the leading experts on giant pandas in the world today, and he felt that that third panda she got was of an age that it could very well have survived after being set free.
Mm. And that panda she called Susan.
That's right.
Yeah. You say that fact, returning a panda that she had captured to the wild, would come as a surprise to many contemporary conservationists. How well known or how little known is the story of Ruth Harkness?
You know, it's amazing. I worked on the book The Modern Ark in 1993. I was working on it, and I was writing a chapter on zoo history. And in that research, I looked up some of the history of the Brookfield Zoo outside Chicago. And it was there that I found a couple of sentences that said, in 1936, a dress designer and a socialite brought the first giant panda ever to be seen in the West. And I thought, my God, there's an incredible story. And as I did my zoo research over the next couple of years, I would ask everyone in the zoo world about what I presumed would be a legend. And no one had ever heard of it. And I thought, how is this possible that a socialite and dress designer, and I say the parallel today, because at that time, in 1936, most people had never even heard of a panda, never mind know what one looked like. Today, the equivalent would be a designer like Stella McCartney or Donna Karan going to the moon and bringing back a creature we've never seen. And that's the only way you can get your mind around what Ruth Harkness actually did and the way that was perceived. Particularly then, it was Depression Age America. The country was really down and out and needed a great feel-good story, which they got. She was covered in the press from coast to coast. Every newsreel, every newspaper, Time magazine called her accomplishment a scientific prize of first magnitude. And in the Washington Post said that every high school kid in the nation knew the name Ruth Harkness. So I thought, how could it be then that today no one knows that name?
She wrote a memoir, also called
The Lady and the Panda.
Is it a good read?
It's a terrific read. In fact, that's what really hooked me. I was interested in her story. I thought, here's something fascinating that went on. And then I ordered her book from a used book dealer in 93 for the outrageous sum, I thought, of $50-something. I thought it was just crazy. But it arrived in its paper wrapper at home, and I set into it, and I discovered a woman who was part Myrna Loy, part Jane Goodall. So modern in her thinking, I felt as though I was talking to a contemporary, very funny. And to me, there were two really important things. One is that Harkness loved giant pandas. This certainly was not just a hunt for her, and she fell in love particularly with Su Lin, her panda. And secondly, something that is very rare, there was no bigotry whatsoever in her writing about China. In fact, quite the opposite. She immersed herself in the philosophy and culture of China, and she felt that she was home when she went there. So there was nothing to overlook in Ruth Harkness's book. But when I finished it, I think I had more questions than when I began. Her book covers just that expedition. I wondered what became of her, and I also wondered what the backstory was. She had a bitter rival named Floyd Tangier Smith, was mentioned in the book, but just in passing, and it opened up lots of other areas of intrigue for me.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about her and her background and her husband. We have Ruth McCombs. She's a dress designer. She came from a comfortable, I don't know if you'd call it working class or middle.
That's a good description.
Comfortable working class, frugal family in Pennsylvania. And she marries this guy, graduate of Harvard, a wealthy young man from New York City, William Harvest Harkness Jr.
Just hearing his name tells you a little bit about who he was. Ruth did transform herself. She came from this little town in western Pennsylvania. And when she went to New York, she remade herself, and she became a real sophisticate who was on the party circuit, particularly in the 20s. It was a time of the flappers, you know, and when you read Ruth's letters and her descriptions of herself, she said there were only two things she hated to do, to go to bed at night and to get up in the morning. She lived the high life in New York City, and she was a real party girl, and so eventually her path crossed with William Harvest Harkness Jr., a Bill. He was a Harvard graduate, independently wealthy, and he lived one of those lives of adventure, and the two of them fell madly in love. And to read Ruth's correspondence about her relationship with Bill, it sounds nearly mystical. They certainly saw themselves as soulmates.
Mm. And here I want to share this description that you have in the book, The Lady and the Panda, of the kind of guy William Harvest Harkness Jr. was, a cocktail shaker in one hand, a pistol in the other, at ease in black tie and in field khaki. So what was it that attracted them to one another? They're two from very different backgrounds.
That's right. I think that what they had, they're as different as night and day, but they went together as well, is the way that I think of it. They both were intrigued by the exotic parts of the world, and it's funny, Ruth described several times looking at maps. At that time, maps of China, for instance, would end, and there would be a big blank area. You know, in the really old maps, it would say, this be where the world ends. Or she was always drawn to those blank areas on maps that were uncharted, and so was Bill. The other thing that they shared, which is very intriguing to me, is that both of them had a paradoxical relationship to being alone. Both of them craved solitude. Both of them battled loneliness. Even when they were in a crowded room, they could experience great pangs of loneliness. Interesting descriptions about Bill from his contemporaries also is that he was known as a pragmatic, shrewd guy with a little bit of mysticism thrown in. And that's a fair description of Ruth Harkness herself. She was intrigued with the spirituality of China. That's really what tugged at her. So I think that they met at some very deep levels, and they were also hard-drinking partiers, and so at some kind of frothy levels, too, the two came together.
Yeah, very good match, but unfortunately, their time together was relatively short, as Bill died in China in 1936. What happened?
Bill Harkness left on a huge expedition that was going to go through Borneo and Indonesia before landing in China. He was going to be part of the race to try to bring the first giant panda back to the West. He had trouble as soon as he got to China. His expedition mates were jumping out of the venture left and right. And he began to experience an illness that Ruth knew nothing about. He was suffering from throat cancer, in fact. And in the city of Shanghai, he had a number, as it turns out, he had something like 7 operations to try to cure himself. And he also attempted during that time, in between those operations, to get out into the field. It was a really disastrous 2 years for him. But he continued to write notes home to his wife, Ruth, that everything was going well and that he expected to be in the field shortly.
How was it that she decided she would carry on?
It's a pretty amazing moment. And I think all of us think about the greatest moments in our life. It is ironic that her freedom came out of the ashes of her husband's death. When she received news that he had died, she was shocked, and she was absolutely devastated by that news. She almost immediately decided that she could not let his mission die with him, and she decided she would take over his expedition, which was absolutely laughable. First of all, for a woman to be doing that at that time in general was crazy. But secondly, Ruth herself says that she was a kind of Manhattanite who would never walk a city block if there was a cab idling nearby. She made this decision, and she felt deep inside that it was something she could do. She had always yearned for adventure herself. And she determined that she got $20,000 in inheritance from Bill, which wasn't much considering his family fortune. But he was kind of a black sheep, and so his personal cash on hand wasn't that much. And she thought she could live a small life and live out that $20,000, or she could have one grand adventure. And that was Ruth Harkness's style. She decided to do that. And the interesting thing to me is that what began as a mission to uphold Bill's name very quickly transformed for her, as soon as she got east, into something deeper, into her own journey.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Vicki Constantine Croke, author of The Lady and the Panda, The True Adventures of the First American Explorer to Bring Back China's Most Exotic Animal. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, what did people close to Ruth Harkness think about her decision to go to China?
They thought it was raucously funny. They thought it was kind of, stunt would be too strong a word, but that it was just kind of a daffy thing for Ruth Harkness to be taking up. And she herself describes the scene in the stateroom of the luxury liner that she was aboard crossing the Atlantic. And you can just imagine those well-dressed swells from Manhattan crowded around her. She said the air was blue from all the cigarette smoke, and they were drinking highballs. And they were teasing her, and she not only took the teasing, she laughed right along with them. She said she wouldn't be able to tell a pheasant from a tufted deer, but she thought if she ran into a panda, she would know what it was. She had one dear friend, Hazel Perkins, a single mother raising two boys, who also believed that Ruth Harkness could get the job done. And so the two of them almost had a private conversation about it that they didn't share with everyone. They did correspond about it, and one of the great things for me in this book is that Hazel Perkins' family contacted me, and they had a treasure trove of hundreds of letters that Ruth had written to her friend Perky over three expeditions and beyond. And because she wanted to use and did use those letters for her own writing, they're filled with vivid detail, but they're also filled with a best friend pouring her heart out to her other friend. So once in Shanghai, Ruth also experienced the kind of laughter that she had in the United States. There were plenty of adventuring men who used Shanghai as their base of operations, and no one took her seriously at all. And another interesting thing to me is that she believed in yin and yang, and that she drew power from weakness. When she went to China, explorers and scientists were required to get all kinds of scientific permits, which were either very slow coming in the case of Bill Harkness, or they wouldn't be given at all. And Ruth had to go up to Beijing to meet with the embassy and ask for some of those permits. And she had an epiphany. She said, if everyone says I'm a dress designer and I'm not an explorer and I'm not an adventurer, then why should I apply for those permits? So one of the things she did was circumvent a very tortured bureaucratic system, and that's part of the reason for her success.
Yeah, she was also a good judge of people.
Yes. Time and time again, she saw characters who had taken advantage of her husband, Bill. She was a Western woman alone who had never led an expedition before, had never been to China before, and yet when she landed in Shanghai, she very quickly believed that her husband's ex-partner was just not up to the task of getting out into the frontier. And by that point, he desperately needed her money to continue his own work. And so a little tango took place in Shanghai where he was courting her, but secretly telling other people he thought it was preposterous that a woman was even attempting this. What he was hoping to do is to get her to finance his further trips to the interior.
Yeah. Now, if I was Donna Curran and I was thinking about picking up my astronaut husband's work and shooting off into space on an expedition to bring back some creature.
A moon bear.
A moon bear. Okay. I wouldn't know where to begin.
She didn't know where to begin either. And what's interesting is one of her husband's ex-partners had come to New York just before she left, and they decided that they would be part of the expedition together. Once she landed in Shanghai and got the lay of the land, and by the way, that was in about a week, she was already writing home about her own plans, she thought to herself, I don't want any of these Western guys with me. What I want to do is go into the Chinese interior with Chinese people. And she had met Quentin Young, who was a 21-year-old explorer, and she decided that she would go with him. It's funny that at that time, no large, well-funded Western expedition would have allowed either Ruth Harkness or Quentin Young to have led it. And yet these two improbable characters hooked up and got the job done.
Mm. Two beautiful people.
That's right. To both of them, this trip was about a lot more than bagging an animal. It was there's a life journey and a spiritual journey going on for both of them as they headed in.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about their personal strength, and they're very good-looking individuals, and I wonder how they were seen by the people that they encountered on their journey.
Well, before they left together, they were at a dinner. Quentin Young was very shy, and Ruth was very outgoing. But Quentin's sister-in-law, Sulin Young, who's still alive, told me that at that dinner, which Ruth describes in Letters Home, that she looked across the table at her very handsome brother-in-law and at this this outgoing woman with large appetites, and she thought that an affair between the two of them would be inevitable, and of course she was right.
Mm. Let's go back to Shanghai. What was the city like when she arrived?
Almost unimaginable. It was the most decadent city in the world at that time. There were more prostitutes per capita in Shanghai. It boasted the longest bar in the world. If you can imagine that, on the dance floor where American jazz was very popular, warlords, they still had warlords then, could run into Hollywood movie stars doing the tango or the carioca. And it was a city that was run by Westerners through an incredible governmental agreement. There was the French Quarter, and then the British and Americans had another area to themselves. They had their own government, their own police force, and that allowed great vice and crime to fester in between the cracks of all of those sections that the city was divided up into. The highest-ranking Chinese detective in the French Quarter also happened to be the leader of the biggest crime syndicate in Shanghai, the Green Gang. So it was like a place nowhere else on the planet. I think it's difficult. We don't even have Shanghai today is not the same as it was then. I don't think there's even a corollary today.
Yeah. Now, she was drawn to what you describe as the Eastern version of the city. What was that part of the city like?
She went into parts of the city, the Chinese area, that most Westerners would never set foot in. And what she found in the spiritual quest that she had was that her concept of heaven or what is heavenly was not just the beautiful and the ethereal, but it was also the nitty-gritty, earthy part of everyday life. And she found in Chinese life a lack of embarrassment about bodies, body functions, about who you are as a person. She felt that she had much more in common in even the dirtiest alleys in the Chinese section of Shanghai than she did at British soirees, where people were wrapped in pearls and had servants.
Hmm. So already we're seeing her transformation, really.
Yes, it happened very quickly. You know, there's an amazing story that she writes from Hong Kong, which is her first stop in China, and in the evening, she had gone up one of the great peaks overlooking the harbor to have dinner with the shipping owner, and they'd gone into the house at sunset, and so she knew the bay was below and that it looked beautiful at sunset. But while they were dining, the sun had set. And afterward, they walked out to have drinks out onto this lawn. And when she got to the edge of the lawn, she gasped because she saw this incredible scene unfolding before her. And that is that the bay below had been turned into a galaxy of its own with Chinese fishermen fishing by torchlight. Above, there were thousands of stars in the sky, so there was no separation between Earth and heaven. And that was the beginning. She said in some inexplicable way she felt home, that she was home. Mm.
Now, her late husband, his dream was to bring back a giant live panda. Had he given any thought to how he was going to do that, how he was going to keep it alive and well through the journey out of China and to the West?
That was always the part that people were worried about. Most all the adventurers who went out into the Chinese frontier, and there were lots of them, the competition was keen to get this done, brought traps and chains and cages with them to subdue the ferocious adult giant panda. And one of the many differences between Ruth and the rest of the panda hunting gang is that she had an epiphany one night. She was in her hotel room, and she thought, and everyone was worried about what you would feed these animals. They knew ate bamboo, and they thought, well, what are we going to feed them when we get away from the bamboo forest? And just as she was about to fall asleep, she thought, what if I got a baby? And so she wrote a providential shopping list on a pad of paper on her nightstand. And so she brought with her a baby bottle and formula, which, of course, turned out to be the most crucial piece of equipment that her expedition carried.
Mm. And it's very fragile, though. Boy, they have to keep an eye on that.
One glass bottle and tissue paper as you're climbing up mountains that are covered in slippery moss and making your way over boulders and over rushing rivers on nothing more than logs thrown across them is very difficult. So that was a really precious piece of equipment that only a couple of people were allowed to handle.
Hmm. Well, thinking of baby pandas, now last week, July 9th, 2005, baby cub born at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and the Washington Post described it this way. The National Zoo's panda, Mei Zhang, gave birth yesterday to a squealing, squirming cub the size of a stick of butter. And elated zookeepers said she is giving it the tender care that befits its status as one of the world's most endangered animals. What can you tell us about Ruth Harkness and her acting as a surrogate? She and Quentin Young as well, surrogate parents almost, if you would, to this baby panda.
The birth of the new baby at the National Zoo really highlights how astonishing Ruth Harkness's accomplishment is. And it's one of the most important factors in hooking me early on. At the time that I first heard about the story, I was writing about zoos, writing about issues of animals in captivity. And in this book that came out in 97, what I knew was that giant pandas were very difficult to not only keep in captivity, but to get them to reproduce, to have their babies survive in captivity, was nearly impossible at that time. And so I thought, how on earth could this socialite have been able to do what our most modern scientists are still struggling with today? And when the news came out from the National Zoo, what we hear is that if that baby panda survives, it will only be the third baby panda born in the United States that would survive into adulthood. And that really italicizes what Ruth Harkness did. And what she did was intuitive. There was no information about feeding or caring for giant pandas. And she says time and again, she allowed the baby to tell her how it should be raised. That is, that every time he squealed for food, they fed him. She also just instinctively kept him close to her body. And we know in the early stages of a baby panda's life, that the mother keeps them on her body 24 hours a day. Later, she has to go out and feed, and she leaves them alone for a while once they're furred. But Harkness did all those things instinctively, and then later, when the baby panda went to the Brookfield Zoo, they were feeding him boiled vegetables. And I have a letter that Harkness wrote to them saying, I'm not a scientist, but I know they eat bamboo in the wild, and I think that we should be feeding him not only bamboo, but other, as she said, flinty substances, hard substances, not just boiled vegetables.
Hmm. The year 1936, a zoo is a very different place than it is today. What did she think about zoos?
She had very mixed feelings about zoos in general. And before she even brought Sulin to the Brookfield Zoo. She wondered aloud, actually, in the pages of New York newspapers, whether she should just turn around and go back to China and bring Sulin back to his native habitat. And there was such an outcry from the public that she decided to stay strong, and that it was very important to introduce this animal to the American public and to have people care about the plight of the species. And ultimately, this is where Desmond Morris, the great zoologist, and also where the World Wildlife Fund says she made her greatest contribution, and that is that she made the world panda conscious, and not just as a stuffed pelt. And she was very aware when she brought Sulin away, she said that she realized this panda was the first one who wasn't a pelt going out to the West, that this was a live being. And the American public saw this animal as an individual with a personality, and so suddenly it wasn't okay to kill them. It wasn't okay if one or two died in the process of being transported. People fell in love with an individual, and that's one of the things that Jane Goodall in modern times talks about, too, the way that you get people to care. So Harkness, I would say, had a love-hate relationship with the zoo world. She would rather see wild animals in wild places, but she was also aware that it was important for people to care about preserving the species.
What is it about the panda that so captures our attention, our imagination?
It's interesting. The scientists say that it's actually we have a biological response to them. We know that it makes good sense in evolution that we have a nurturing response to human infants, and pandas have what human babies have, but in spades. They have big bobble heads, what appears to be large eyes, even though it's the black patches over their eyes. They look like they have little mittened hands because they have an extended wrist bone that looks like a thumb. And they sit upright and eat. And so we basically can't even fight our own biology. When we see these animals, we want to cuddle them, protect them, and people just go from the first time that Ruth brought the panda to the United States through today, obviously, people are just captivated by giant pandas.
Mm. You know, you mentioned earlier, you said, you know, we're going to take a trip to the moon and look for the moon bear. And, you know, I think that would be a wonderful name for this animal in Chinese, moon bear.
That's great.
Because of their wonderful face.
Yes, you're right. The Chinese call, they have lots of names for the giant panda. It's interesting that the references to the species are really spotty throughout ancient texts and in art. They're often called a cat bear. They were sometimes called the white leopard. In those old texts, but even in China itself, if you weren't in the mountains where the pandas were, people really didn't know very much about them, just outside of the place where you could actually find the panda.
You know, Ruth Harkness, as you mentioned, had mixed feelings about zoos, and I think today we have mixed feelings about zoos. What are your thoughts about zoos?
Well, I've written a book called The Modern Ark, and I have thought a lot about issues of animals in captivity. And what it comes down to is that paradox that the bottom line is that wild animals don't belong behind bars. And yet, we are watching civilization encroach on every shred of wild habitat that's left in the world today. We're beginning to have to manage wild populations the way we do animals in captivity. And what I've seen happening in the last 10 years is a pretty remarkable transformation. There used to be a separation between the guys who are wildlife biologists in the field and the people who are in the zoo world. That line is completely blurred now. And all of the science about anesthetizing animals and there's contribution from the zoo world to saving animals in the wild is enormous, and it's only increasing. Zoos have made great strides in becoming conservation organizations in the last 10 years, and that's something to cheer. I think ultimately, when we view animals in captivity as ambassadors, it's true. I mean, those animals are giving something up. I mean, they're gaining something too, obviously. They're free from predators and parasites, but in the worst-case scenario, they're bored out of their minds. We've gotten better and better at providing enrichment. We don't do it as much as I would like to see, But for me, it's not a black and white issue. It's a very complex one, and I'm pro zoo. I say that with a little bit of caution because I think zoos can always do better and better.
I was talking with my husband last night about the mama bear at the National Zoo and the great concern over this tiny, tiny bear. You know, we were sitting at dinner and there was a stick of butter on the table. You know, and the concern at the zoo is the mother going to be, is she going to know what to do? And is she going to take good care of her cub? And we were wondering, is that something that, you know, is strictly instinctual, or is that something that in the wild pandas would learn from one another?
It's that little baby is 1/900th the weight of its mother. We have been learning over time just that question. It's not as simple as people think it is. It varies from species to species, what's hardwired and what is learned. We know from animals like the elephant or the gorilla that in the wild they grow up watching sex, watching birth, often displaying this auntie behavior, learning how to raise babies themselves. Pandas are more solitary than that, but we've had a really hard time with panda mothers knowing what to do in captivity. And science continues today, biologists continue today, to try to figure out what's different in the captive environment that might have been causing a mother to abandon her baby. One of the things that we found out in the last several years is that we're unlocking the mysteries of the way that pandas use chemical signaling. And all of those things are questions. We also have to say, what's the mortality rate in the wild? We had a worse mortality rate in captivity than pandas do in the wild, which is a reverse of the way it usually is. So we continue to learn how to make that environment one in which a panda mother can feel comfortable enough to raise her baby. In the case of the pandas who were at the Sing Sing and Ling Ling at the National Zoo previously, they were much older, and that was considered a contributing factor in her inability to raise the babies.
Well, back to our story of Ruth Harkness and her quest for the panda. What would you like to tell us about the challenges of traveling across China that she and Quentin Young had to get through?
It's remarkable what they went through. Even today, George Schaller, the great naturalist, thinks of that area up by the Wulong Reserve, which is in the next valley is where Harkness got her panda, as some of the toughest terrain on the planet. And you add to that that there really were great hordes of bandits, sometimes numbering like in the hundreds in the area. Also, there were the people who lived in that, in western China, in this strange borderland between China and Tibet, did not appreciate foreigners coming in. They were warlike people. And so danger was in just the natural landscape, these mountains where you could slip and fall thousands of feet to your death, from the people who lived there, from bandits who were roaming around. And I retraced Ruth's journey, and we could cover, when we were in the Chinese-Tibetan border, in 2 hours in jeeps, what would take 2 days on foot for Harkness's party. And yet Harkness herself had never felt better in her life. She had never been happier or felt more centered than when she was hiking 30 miles a day in this rough terrain.
What was that trip like for you? I believe it was from, you retraced her steps from Hong Kong to Shanghai.
That's right. We went from Hong Kong to Shanghai, then up the Yangtze River.
Uh-huh.
We went to Chengdu, an important city at the far frontier of the Chinese border. And I had with me a modern generation of the people associated with Ruth in 1936. Ruth Harkness's niece, Mary Lubisco, came, and her daughter, Nicole. Ruth Harkness's best friend, Hazel Perkins, her granddaughter, came. And Quentin Young's niece, Jolly Young. And Jolly Young's parents were also explorers, and her mother is the person that Ruth named the panda after, Su Lin. So for all of us, it was a very, very important journey, and Mary Lubisco, Ruth's niece, had Ruth's ashes dug up from the cemetery in Titusville, Pennsylvania. She carried them in a little case with a panda on it. And we brought her ashes to the mountains of western China, to the very area where she found Su Lin, and Mary left her ashes there, which I think is really very fitting.
Mm. It must have been very emotional.
It was an incredible moment, particularly because one of the things that Harkness wrote about over and over again is her connection to the people, particularly in the rural areas. And she had a line in her book saying that a smile never went, even though people were kind of aghast to see a white, many of them had never seen a white person before, but whenever she smiled at them, she said, no smile went unreturned. And over again, she writes about the hospitality that she met out there. And we had that same experience, particularly because we brought back pictures that Harkness had taken in 1936. The Cultural Revolution wiped out so many buildings and so many memories for China that in every village we went to, we often had photographs of their own village from that time that they had never seen before. Mm-hmm. So people would pour out of their houses, and they didn't want to just look at the pictures. They wanted to hold them themselves. So we felt that I knew that I wouldn't really understand Ruth Harkness until I immersed myself in China. And it was in those moments that we thought, oh, I know who she is.
Many of those photographs are in the book. Do you have a favorite?
I think any picture of Ruth cuddling Su Lin is interesting to me, particularly because as I've looked at all of those pictures and all of those newsreels, Harkness never mugged for the camera. This was a moment of great celebrity for her, but that was the last thing on her mind. Her attention was always focused on the panda, and it's rare to even see her face in these hundreds of photographs that exist of her with the panda. She's always looking down, focused on Su Lin, and she wrote about the panda in those terms too. She rarely even called the animal Su Lin. He was just referred to as baby.
Hmm. You know, thinking back now to the pictures that you've included in the book of Ruth Harkness, she wasn't a camera hog at all. I don't know if that was on purpose, she understood that maybe a woman needed to have a little mystery about her, but that's interesting.
She wasn't photogenic either. One of the things that became clear in writings about her is, for one thing, I think she didn't come across as well on film, but she also possessed a kind of charisma. It made me think of the line from Gone with the Wind. It's one of the first lines in the book. It says that Scarlett O'Hara was not beautiful, but that men rarely realize that when taken up by her charm. And in the story of Ruth Harkness, particularly when other people are writing about her, that's palpable. People felt, in the few interviews I was able to do with people alive today who knew her, they said she just would light up a room when she walked in. Extremely charismatic, very compelling person. And men and women alike were equally drawn to her.
Mm. How did she feel about having that charisma? And how did she feel about celebrity?
She said, there's a line from one of her letters. She said, if only people realized what an empty thing celebrity is. It never mattered to her. What she wanted to be able to do is use whatever influence she had to help the giant panda. And she herself did not care about being famous, about making, she made a Hollywood best dress list and things like that. She wanted to live the life of an explorer, and whatever she did was toward that goal, helping the panda and getting back out into the field herself.
Hmm. You're in Chicago today, July 12th. We have listeners in the Chicagoland area. Are you going to be doing a book signing anywhere?
I am. I'm at Anderson's Bookshop, I think it's in Naperville, mm-hmm. tonight, and at Schwartz's, which is, I think, a well-known bookstore near Milwaukee tomorrow night. Okay. And I've just returned from the Brookfield Zoo where Su Lin was. I did a signing there.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Celeste, it's been a delight. Thank you.
Vicki Constantine Crook has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Lady and the Panda, The True Adventures of the First American Explorer to Bring Back China's Most Exotic Animal. The book is published by Random House. And that interview was conducted on July 12th of this year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Indeed, the settlement prices are in today, and most contracts, Celeste, posted small gains today, but well off session highs in what was an extremely light volume day as the trade continues to mark time ahead of Friday's USDA crop production reports, waiting for those numbers to come out and see whether or not USDA will lower its yield estimates for both corn and soybeans. Let's go ahead and get you caught up on the settlement prices, and as we always do, begin in the wheat pit. September wheat, a high on the day of 325.5, a low of 321.5, settling 322.25, up 2.25 on the day. December, a high of 340, a low of 336.5, settling 337.5, up 1.5. March, a high of 352, a low of 349, settling 350.5, up 1.5. May, a high of 358, a low of 355, settling 357, up 2. And the July wheat contract, a high of 362, a low of 359.25, settling 360.25, up 3 on the day. September corn, a high of 226.5, a low of 221, settling 222, up 1.5. December, a high of 239.5, a low of 235, settling 235.75, up 1.25. March, a high of 247.75, a low of 243, settling 243.5, unchanged on the day. The May contract, a high of 253.5, a low of 248.5, settling 248.75, up 0.5. July corn, a high of 257.5, a low of 252, settling 252.75, unchanged on the day. The September contract unchanged as well. The high there, 254.5, the low 251.5, settling on the low on the day. September oats, a high of 161.5, a low of 156.5, settling 159, up 3.75. December, a high of 169.75, a low of 165.25, settling 168, up 4.25. August soybeans, a high of 670, a low of 660, settling 660.5, up 2. September, a high of 674, a low of 662.5, settling 664.25, up 2.5. November, a high of 680, a low of 669.5, settling 670.75, up 1.75. That your most active contract of the day. January, a high of 684, a low of 674.5, settling 674.75, up 3/4. March, a high of 680.5, a low of 671, settling 671.25, down 3/4. May, a high of 676, a low of 667, settling 668, up 2 on the day. August soybean meal, a high of 214.50, a low of 211, settling 211.70, up 80. September, a high of 212, a low of 208.80, settling 209.60, up 80. August soybean oil, a high of 23.85, a low of 23.40, settling 23.44, down 18. September, a high of 23.94, a low of 23.45, settling 23.49, down 20 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where many contracts, Celeste, were down more than 100 points today.
That's right. Let's begin with August feeder cattle, 110.80. The high, 109.40. The low, the settlement, 109.50. That down 90. September, 109.35. The high, 106.95. The low, the settlement, 107.07.5. That down 150. October, 108.80. The high, 106.45. The low, 106.47.5. The settlement, that down 155. August live cattle, 80.90, the high, 79.75, the low, 79.80, the settlement, that down 77.5. October live cattle, 82.17.5, the high, 80.70, the low, 80.72.5, the settlement, that down 120. August lean hogs, 70.22.5, the high, 69.50, the low, 69.57.5, the settlement, that down 52.5. October 61.10, the high, 59.40, the low, the settlement 59.45, that down 132.5. December 58.85, the high 57.85, the low. The settlement 57.92.5, that down 85. February lean hogs 60 even, the high. The low 59.25, the settlement 59.75, that down 37.5. And August pork bellies 71.50, the high, the low, and the settlement 67.95, that down $2. The Dow is off 22 points at 10,536. The NASDAQ off 11 points at 21.67, and the S&P 500 down 3 at 12.24. The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ray Wong from Hong Kong writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what is the relationship between turgidity of potato cells and the molar concentration of the surrounding medium?"
I'm pleased to say there's no relationship between them at all. There is, however, a distinct linear, though often exponential, relationship between the price of potatoes and their taste. A double-blind, deep-fat-fried study of potato cells and their relationship to licensed mediums was performed by the highly respected Psychics Network. Those TV visionaries found no correlation between any of the variables, but they did manage to eat any potato product that was put in front of them, and then they billed the researchers $400 an hour for their time. Clever, those psychics.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Live Show on DVD, go to drscience.com.
It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 85 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the U of I. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director this afternoon, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Marcia Eastrom's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: becoming partly sunny, highs between 89 and 94. Tonight in northern and central Illinois and northern Indiana, partly cloudy. In central Indiana and in the south, mostly cloudy, with the possibility of showers and thunderstorms. Lows tonight between 65 and 69. Tomorrow, patchy, dense fog in east central Illinois and western Indiana during the morning hours. Then in northern and central sections,